We're going to take a short break for one of our sponsors. I haven't tried this one, but it looks well worth checking out if weight loss has been an ongoing challenge for you. Robody pairs medication options with diet and exercise modifications to achieve your desired goal. Before being prescribed any medication, patients complete an online medical visit, lab test, and more to see if you're right for their program. You can sign up online, which means no scheduling a doctor's appointment, no commute to the doctor's office, and no waiting rooms. Their data shows that average weight loss is 15 to 20% in 1 year with healthy lifestyle changes. BMI and other eligibility criteria apply. Go to ro.co/untangle. Sign up today and you'll pay just $99 a month for your first month and $145 a month after that. Medication costs are separate. That's ro.co/untangle. Now, back to our show. We're taking a short break to tell you a little bit about the 10% Happier podcast hosted by my friend Dan Harris. It has one guiding philosophy. Happiness is a skill you can learn, so why not master it? I recently talked to him on our show about what has changed since he wrote 10% Happier 10 years ago. A lot. Dan was once a fidgety, skeptical journalist, but after suffering a panic attack on national television, he decided to change his life. This journey led him to learn everything he could about the human psyche. Now he's on a quest to help others achieve peace and happiness. Each week, he talks to top scientists, meditation teachers, and even the odd celebrity, exploring topics like productivity, anxiety, enlightenment, psychedelics, and relationships. He's funny. He's smart. He's one of the best interviewers I know. Think of listening to 10% Happier as a workout for your mind. The 10% Happier podcast is available wherever you listen to podcasts. Welcome to Untangle, the podcast from five-star app Meditation Studio. I'm Patricia Karpis, co-founder of Meditation Studio and your host on Untangle, along with my co-host, Ariel Garten, one of the founders of brain sensing headband Muse. Join us each week as we introduce you to authors, experts, and thought leaders who share their stories on how meditation, mindfulness, and brain-focused practices have the power to change our lives. Whether you're just learning to meditate or want to deepen your practice, Meditation Studio, with hundreds of guided meditations, and Muse, which provides great feedback on your practice, are two awesome tools you'll want to have in your back pocket. Now, on to Ariel and today's interview.
Hello and welcome. My name is Ariel Garten, and today our guest is Dr. Dan Siegel. He's the founder of the whole field of interpersonal neurobiology. He's a neuroscientist, psychiatrist, he's trained as a pediatrician, and he's the author of multiple books for general audience and to train psychiatrists. He's also one of the leading voices in the neuroscience and neurobiology of mindfulness and meditation, which he likes to refer to as mindsight. He's also a father of how many, Dan?
Two adult children, yes.
Wonderful. Because today he's here to share his insights on both how the mind and brain work together and also to give homage to the father. Whether you are one, you have one, or had one, you might be one, or you had an estranged relationship to one, there are valuable insights in today's podcast for you. So let's get inside the mind of Dr. Dan Siegel.
Thank you. It's great to be here with you, Ariel. You know, these questions about this field, which my colleagues and I actually have founded, we think of it as a community where we're bringing all the sciences together into one framework, inform things like parenting and the role of mothers and fathers, and also how the field of mindful awareness, which is very new to me actually, relate to fundamental ways that we have insight into ourselves, empathy for others, and a way to integrate, which is to allow people to be different and then link to each other, which is basically the fundamental mechanism beneath compassion and kindness. So we look at those three things, insight, empathy, and integration, as foundational to what mindsight is. And then you can say, well, what would mindsight parenting be? What would a mindsight life be like? How would you make a mindsight school? What would you be if you were MindSight mother or MindSight father? And that's the kind of stuff we do.
Can we step back for a moment and define MindSight? Because I know lots of people here are familiar with the terms mindfulness or meditation, and MindSight has its own, pardon the pun, view on it.
That's right. Well, when I was in medical school, I dropped out because the teachers lacked something. I couldn't really say what it was. And for me, when I was away, I was really struggling because I always thought I wanted to be a physician, but something about the medical training was, I don't know how to describe it, kind of off, I guess you could say. So what I did was I made up this term MindSight for how you see the mind of another person, let's say a patient. You see what they're feeling. You sense what they might have as a meaning if you tell them there's an illness going on, or, you know, this capacity to see the mind. I had never heard of such a thing, but it seemed like it was what was missing when I was in training. And it could also be a form of perception, very different from when you see the physical world. So my professors of medicine could see, you know, an x-ray, let's say, and say you had a broken bone, and that was a physical thing they could see with their eyes. But somehow they could tell a person their bones were dissolving. I had one patient with, you know, this kind of disease where your bones turned into sponge, and he was very depressed because it meant he wouldn't be able to walk. And the physicians teaching me to care for him told me to stop feeling so much for this person and to stop worrying.
Oh, I'm sorry. Ow.
Yeah, exactly. So it was things like that over and over and over again that got me to drop out of school. So the bottom line is, back in 1979, when this was happening, 1980, when I dropped out of school, I decided ultimately to go back, and I needed a word to protect me that could embrace the idea that there is this physical sight. So these professors were really good at that. You know, they were really renowned researchers and all this stuff. And that was important. So it's not to put that down. If you have a broken bone, you want someone else, you repair it. But you also want someone who sees that you have feelings about having a broken bone. So you might not be able to see a feeling with the same perceptual system, but it seemed to me you were seeing the mind. So I made up the word mind sight for seeing the mind. And then I would study, when I went back to school, how some professors of medicine that were my teachers were really good at this. They were the rare ones. And some were terrible at it. And their patients didn't seem to do so well if their minds were not being seen. So when I went into pediatrics and ultimately psychiatry and then child and adolescent psychiatry and then became a researcher in attachment, I was very interested to see if this idea of MindSight that had been what had saved my mind, basically, was actually useful in understanding how people dealt with life, you know, how parents took care of children, for example, or how two people in a friendship were with each other, or a romantic couple, or a family, or even a school, or maybe even like an organization. So you can look at MindSight, and whether it's cultivated or not, and then see its components, which are insight into one's own inner experience, empathy, which allows you to do a number of things, including sensing the feelings of another and imagining what it's like to see from their perspective, and also what it would be like to have them understood in a way where you understand the thoughts, the feelings, the meanings in that particular person's inner experience. That's empathy. And then the third component, so it's insight, empathy, is basically integration, which is this weird word for a very simple process where things are allowed to be different and then connected. So in an attachment relationship, you know, you're talking about fathers and Father's Day and, you know, basically fathers who help their children thrive, or mothers too, you know, allow integration to be at the heart of what happens in the parenting experience, so that what you're doing is you're saying, my child is different from me, different from what I expected her to be, but I'm going to allow those differences, in fact, even enjoy and thrive with those differences, but then promote compassionate communication as a linkage. So integration is the differentiation and then connection. And when you link these differentiated parts, that's what integration is. And so that's what gives rise to compassion and kindness and caring, basically, of love. And so insight is the first, empathy, the second, integration, the third, which is what love, compassion, and kindness are all about.
So this really resonates with me. As a mom of a young child, I understand how that process of mindsight is so key. You know, my child is growing and developing, and as a parent, my job is to figure out what he needs. He's crying. Is he hungry? Is his diaper wet? He, you know, has that look of yearning. He has this little irritation. What is it coming from? How do I understand him intimately, possibly at this point, even more deeply than he understands himself, because he's still figuring it out. And then how can I use that to provide care? How can I empathize with him in his situation, use that to provide care? And that active care is the building of love.
Exactly. Yeah. And that what's amazing is, Ariel, if you take that beautiful description of your connection with your son, you know, you would see that you're creating an integrated relationship. And what's absolutely fascinating about using integration as a fundamental mechanism of our relationships is you can show that that creates integration in his brain. And integration in his brain is the basis of all regulation, regulating attention, emotion and mood, thought, reasoning, morality, behavior, the way you connect with other people in relational connections. So what has been amazing to me and the interns I have working with me to revise this textbook that all this is summarized in, The Developing Mind, is that there's a ton of science that doesn't say it this directly, but this sentence is supported by the science. Relational integration leads to the growth of brain integration, which is the basis of all regulation and the mechanism of health.
Wow.
And that's it.
That's a phenomenal phrase. Can you unpack a little bit more what you mean by integration in the brain and talk a little bit more about this neurological integration, how it can give rise to self-regulation and all these higher order processes?
Let's start with just the term integration first and then dive into the brain. You know, integration is a word that we can kind of get a feeling for just by the name of it. Integration, it sounds good. Mm-hmm. What is it exactly? Well, it's where, let's say if we talk about you and me right now in our relationship, this relationship where people are listening, they could see if you asked me the question and I ignored the question, you would be differentiated from me, but there'd be no linkage. So it wouldn't be an integrated communication. Or if you insisted that I only say exactly what you wanted me to say and not what I had in my mind, that would be too much linkage without differentiation. So
I can see some bad parenting habits growing at that example.
Exactly. Yes. Well, there you go. So you need both. It's kind of like a balancing act of differentiation, things being different or specialized, unique, allowed to be themselves. Think of fruit in a fruit salad, right? And you link them by putting them in the same bowl, but it's not like a smoothie where you blend it up in a grinder and then it's homogeneous, right? It's not a smoothie. Integration is a fruit salad. So what's
cool about it, juices mingling in the bottom. Yep.
Juices mingling in the bottom. And that's the synergy of integration. You wouldn't get those tastes that you get and the textures of them combining them together and even the juice that comes together. So synergy, which is how something coming together with different elements gives rise to something else. We call that emergent. This is where the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. But in integration, you don't lose the individual parts. So you're not losing yourself, and I'm not losing myself, but we're creating a we that's bigger than just the you and me. But we're not losing you and me. See, that's where it's so exciting. And the same thing is true in the brain. So you have different areas of the brain, like left and right, that are connected through the corpus callosum. Secure attachment leads to a solid, healthy growth of the corpus callosum, linking the left and right. What else do you have? You have the hippocampus that links different areas of memory to each other. The prefrontal cortex behind your forehead, that area basically takes these five differentiated sources of energy and information flow. One, the cortex. Two, the limbic area. Three, the brainstem. Four, the body. Five, the signals from other people's expressions, their communications. So the social, the somatic, the brainstem, the limbic, and the cortical are five relatively distinct, differentiated, they're different, sources of energy flow, and the prefrontal cortex links them all together. So that's a third way we understand integration of the brain. The fourth is the word, if you take the word connect and put the letters O-M-E at the end, it's called the connectome. Yeah. It's the way we study the more subtly differentiated areas throughout the whole brain and the more subtly different linked pathways. And you can do this in exciting ways, both functionally and structurally. Anyway, what you can show is that an integrated brain has a more interconnected connectome. And this is what is the highest correlation with every measure of well-being they could find. And unfortunately, when kids have the opposite of secure attachment, severe neglect or severe abuse called developmental trauma, one of the main findings besides the prefrontal cortex not growing well, the hippocampus not growing well, and the corpus callosum not growing well, is the connectivity of the connectome is significantly reduced. So you have less integration in the brain when you have the opposite of integrative relationships, which is abuse and neglect. And so what we can infer from that is that when you provide these secure attachments, you do offer the growth of integration in the brain. And what's really fascinating about this, and this is how I got into this whole strange journey, really, of by accident, in a book I wrote with my colleague Mary Hartzell, we wrote, well, to develop secure attachment, you should have the kind of presence that allows you to be caring and conscientious and conscious of what you're doing, do things with intentionality. Mary and I said, what should we call that? We said, well, that's just be mindful, you know? And then when people read the book, they said, oh gosh, when are you going to teach us to meditate? And we said, excuse us, what are you saying? They said, meditation, your book says meditation. Neither Mary nor I were meditators. And so we said, which book? And they go, this book, Parenting from the Inside Out. And they point to the word be mindful, that phrase. And we said, they said, that's be a meditator. And I go, why do you say that? And they go, well, it's mindfulness meditation, you know? And I said, well, I'm not familiar with that, but we just meant be caring and conscientious. So right after those workshops, this is 2004, I was put on.
We'll take a short break for one of our awesome sponsors, Born Shoes. I was so excited to try these cute casual sandals made with top quality leather, perfect for all the traveling that I do. They're so comfortable for walking anywhere. I know exactly why their tagline is take comfort in Born Shoes. Perfect. There are five new styles this spring, and I tried Ithaca and absolutely love them. But they also have boots and heels you should try. They feel as good as they look. Go to bornshoes.com today for a 15% discount plus ground shipping on all full price shoes when you use my promo code UNTANGLE. That's promo code UNTANGLE for 15% off and free shipping. Available exclusively to our listeners for just a limited time. Now, back to our show.
On a panel in 2005 with a guy named Jon Kabat-Zinn, who I'd never heard of. So I read his two books and I read his two papers. And what was amazing about it was Jon Kabat-Zinn and his research colleague, Richie Davidson, had shown certain outcomes of mindfulness-based work and mindfulness-based stress reduction that, in my view, as an attachment researcher, overlap beautifully with secure attachment outcomes. And so then it became where Jon became this time on the panel where Jon said, you should go learn something about meditation because I didn't know anything about it. And when I went to do my first meditation experience, was a week-long silent retreat, I came to sense that the experience of this mindfulness meditation process was a way of attuning to my internal world with MindSight, you know, that was very much like the interpersonal attunement a parent does with a child's mind. So then I thought, wow, you have inner attunement with mindfulness, interpersonal attunement with secure attachment. Maybe there's something about the focusing of attention on the inner world called attunement when it's leading to this resonance allows a more integrative state of energy flow to arise relationally for parent-child relationships or even within the individual. So the guess at that time, this is a long time ago, 2006, the guess was maybe if we could do studies of the brains of individuals who were doing mindfulness meditation, you might show integration of the brain. That was the guess. Then years later, guess what? Here are the major findings of mindfulness meditation in the brain. The corpus callosum grows.
Yep.
The hippocampus grows. The prefrontal cortex grows. And the connectome becomes more interconnected. So the predictions of the hypothesis back in the early mid-2000s came true, you know, now it's way over 10 years later. So what that suggests is there's something about integration, whether it's cultivated with mindful awareness internally or with relational integration, that seems to go along with that is stimulate the growth of integration of the brain, which now, as of 2015, the Smith et al. Paper shows that that's the best predictor of health and well-being.
That's amazing. So you've just shared a whole bunch of information. I'm going to weave it together a little bit with my own experience. So what I just heard was that when you cultivate this property of mind sight, the ability to see inside your own state, to be attuned, and to be able to see somebody else's state, you're actually sort of forging the same pathways that secure attachment forges, and also the same pathways that meditation forges. So what you're doing is you're creating a sense of presence, both with yourself and the ability to be present with someone else, which forms the basis of, or is the same thing as, creates the same thing as secure attachment, which is so fundamental, and can create the same neurobiology of interconnection, which leads to health and well-being and positive outcomes as a meditation practice does, because both encourage greater integration.
Exactly. Beautifully said.
It's an incredible weaving of multiple fields to the same end. I know, you know, parents are often fascinated by, if you're a meditation practitioner, you want to be a mindful parent. And you think you're being a mindful parent by controlling your own emotions, being able to be, you know, generous to your child and not yell at them. You know, there's a lot of that dialogue in the mindfulness space, you know, how you show up for your kid. But it's actually the act of being mindful of them and with them, that being present together and having mind sight, that is itself the gift. That is the thing that is promoting integration of the two of you together and integration of each of your brains and then allowing the well-being to flourish. That's kind of mind-blowing.
Is it mind-blowing?
Mind was just slightly blown. So thank you.
It is. It's so beautiful the way you're saying it. And, you know, when you define mind sight in this very clear way, insight, empathy, and integration, the integration is happening in a relational way. So that's compassion and kindness. The integration is also happening in a neurological way. So when you talk about the pathways, literally what Ariel is talking about are neural pathways.
Yes.
And the way you can remember this is presence is the portal through which integration arises. So you can cultivate this capacity for presence, and then you come to experience integration within your body. And there's all sorts of positive outcomes of, you know, I call it three-pillar mind training, you know, focused attention, open awareness, kind intention cultivation. The three-pillar mind training is where you learn to focus your attention, open your awareness, and cultivate kind intention, which has a quality of compassion and kindness and love, kind regard towards one's inner experience, kind regard for the inner experience of people not born into your body. I don't like the word other, because a more integrated identity.
That's awesome.
You know? And I really try to avoid the word self and other. Oh my God, it drives me nuts. Because the self is really broader than your brain, and it's bigger than your body. It's about your connections with people not born into the body you're born into, and about nature, you know? And anyway, so I call that a mwe. You know, it's me plus we equals mwe. And that word has been really, I think, captivating the practical ways we say, well, what's the word we use for an integrated identity that embraces the reality of our interconnections and allows integration to be at the heart of it? Because you don't want to let go of the inner experience.
Three-pillar mind training.
So I like that. Basically, you've taken, whether we call it mindfulness, meditation, we can all agree, at least we're training three things: focused attention, open awareness, and kind regard for others. When we do this, what are some of the benefits that emerge?
It integrates your brain, number one. Number two, it leads to five huge changes in your physiology that's just worth quickly summarizing. When you do three-pillar mind training, this inner work you can do, it allows you to reduce stress. So the cortisol hormone is reduced. It allows you to improve immune function. It allows you to make the heart and the head work more collaboratively with each other and reduce cardiovascular risk factors like lowering elevated blood pressure, lowering cholesterol. It actually alters the regulatory molecules, histones and methyl groups, on top of the DNA, the genes that regulate inflammation. So it reduces inflammation by altering how your cells are actually regulating your genes. That's number four. And number five, it actually optimizes an enzyme called telomerase. And telomerase is the enzyme that repairs the telomeres, which are the ends of your chromosomes. So it's like if you have a shoelace, you know, this is like the cap on the shoelace. If you're going to stick it through that little eyelet, you want the cap to be intact. When your cells divide, they need the caps on the chromosomes to be intact. As we get older and with stress, those telomere caps get shorter and shorter and shorter until our DNA frays, our cells get sick and die, and we get sick and die. So three-pillar mind training optimizes telomerase levels, and the Nobel Prize winner Elizabeth Blackburn and her wonderful colleague Alyssa Eppel wrote a great book called The Telomere Effect. When Alyssa read the book, before it went to press, she said, Dan, you have to put something else in the book. You left it out. And I said, oh my God, another chapter. She goes, did it go to the printer yet? I said, no, it's going in 3 days. What did I leave out? She goes, you just have to say that these trainings that are on this one practice called the Wheel of Awareness, all three pillars, that they slow the aging process.
No.
And I said, that's audacious. You know, how can I say that? She said, because we, that is Alyssa Eppel, this renowned scientist, and the Nobel Prize winner, Elizabeth Blackburn, have found that to be the case. So presence actually is the mental state that actually slows the aging process.
Not only does it feel like time is standing still when you're fully present, but there's actually cellular aging effects that diminish through that process.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Cellular aging. And you know what's so interesting about that? When Alyssa and I, with two of my interns, Ben Nelson and Suzanne Parker, we were writing a chapter to say, why does presence do that? Why does presence alter the cellular mechanisms to slow the aging process? So we use this proposal that comes up, and you'll see it in the book Aware, you know, of what awareness really is. So the subtitle of the book is the science and practice of presence, because presence as the portal for integration does have these five physiological changes. But the question is why? And so it'd be a long, long story, more than we have time to do here, but I'll just say that, you know, there are these scientifically established dual, that is two aspects of one reality. And I think consciousness, the experience of being aware, presence basically, drops you into this microstate realm, which has no directionality of change, called arrow of time. It is timeless. And I've done this study with 10,000 people on the Wheel of Awareness. And we just did it this last weekend in Toronto. And people will drop into the hub of a wheel, which is the visual mechanism is, everything you can be aware of is on the rim. The experience of knowing, of being aware, is in the hub. So people have this opportunity to take a spoke and move it around the rim. And then at some point in the practice, we bend the spoke around or just retract the spoke and just rest in the hub. And people who've never meditated before in their lives, or they're teaching meditation for decades, will have this experience of going from a very time-bound experience, there's now and a now, into a timelessness. And it's a long story, but I think that the origin of consciousness is when this energy probability position has moved into the spaciousness. We can't get into that here, but just to say that I think there's a deep mechanism on why presence feels so good. It connects us to others because their presence and your presence arising from the same, I call it plane of possibility. And so far, I've now done this with 45,000 people in person, and just added another, whatever was this weekend, you know, another 250 in a workshop, you know, and you see this incredible raising of hands. When you did, I didn't want to do this a couple of times in a room of 3,000. And I'll say, how many of you, when you got into the hub, felt time disappear? And you'll see 1,000 hands go up. Right. And so I think we're at this moment of really having a possible insight into why presence for parenting, let's say for fathers listening to this or mothers listening to this, why you starting with your own inner life and developing this capacity to open your mind and open your awareness up in this very important way for your own physiological health, that's the insight part, will allow you to have the at least five elements of empathy, the second part of mindset, which is you're going to feel the feelings of your child. So they're going to feel felt. You're going to allow yourself to take their perspective, to understand from their point of view, to have empathic joy, so you're really happy when they're happy, and even have empathic concern, which is when you care when they're suffering. And that's a gateway to compassion, which is where integration comes in, the third aspect of mindset. So it's insight, empathy, and integration. And then it all kind of makes sense, and all the scientific studies fit in, and the practical suggestions for parenting or just the personal work that one needs to do to make sense of your life, they all kind of fit together.
That's amazing.
So— Hello, listeners. This is Michael from the Psychologists of the Clock podcast. If you like what you hear on Untangle, let me extend a friendly invitation to check out our show as well. We are four experts in psychology that bring you cutting-edge and science-based ideas to help you flourish in your relationships, work, and health. You can find Psychologists of the Clock wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts, and you can visit our website at offtheclockpsych.com.
So can we tighten the lens a little bit more closely on fathers? Because we tend to think about attachment parenting as something focused on a mother, but there's, I know in your work, that's not the case at all.
No, right. I mean, you know, in interpersonal neurobiology, we try to draw on all the fields of science to understand the nature of being human and reality and stuff like that. So in anthropology, we know that human beings, unlike many other mammals, have what's called alloparenting, and we evolved to have more than one caregiver. And so it absolutely is not just about the relationship of the child to the mother. So even though I know some people write about that and all that stuff, I think the evidence is very clear that human beings have alloparenting. And what that means is we as a species not only are capable of having more than one attachment, it's actually good for us to have these different connections and to basically be grown up in a village. We're very communal, collaborative creatures. In fact, it's probably why we first become aware of the mind of another before we even become aware of our own mind. And that's a whole, you know, interesting kind of history for us. Developmentally, you see this too, that the baby first feels an experience of joining with the mother or father or other caregiver in a way that allows them, when you study in my field of attachment research, when you study parent-child relationships, you see this incredible richness of connection long before the baby is even having this thing called theory of mind or, you know, saying, oh, I've got a mind too. And, you know, it's a feeling of being felt by another, feeling felt. So anyway, this is why when you draw on anthropology or the field of attachment, then a statement like it's all about just the mother actually is not scientific. So, and it's also not, you know, I mean, when you see the practice of it, we're very communal creatures.
So the father plays an equal role to the mother, and possibly some of the things that we think of as motherly duties are equally fatherly possibilities.
Yeah, I would be myself. I'd be careful of the word equal, only for the integration term we started with, Ariel, because I think what you mean is also plays an important role. With the word equal, sometimes people want to say it's the same, right? And so, no, they're not the same. No one's the same. Everyone's unique. So every caregiver has a unique role, and there is something called a primary attachment figure. And in our culture, it's often the mother, not always. Could be the grandmother, could be all sorts of people. But So I would say that, yes, there's also a very important role for the father as an attachment figure in the baby's life, for sure.
Can you talk a little bit more about how as a father to become that attachment figure?
Yeah, well, there's four S's that I think are helpful to just remember what are the key ingredients of secure attachment, just as you're asking. And fathers knowing this, that they have a very important role to play also, can help them. So the first is seen, S-E-E-N. So when a baby is seen, it means that her inner life, the feelings, the thoughts, the meanings of things, her perceptual experience, that is her point of view, all of that and her memories, all of that is tuned into by the caregiver. In this case, we're talking about the father tuning, let's say, to a daughter. The next is that you see that the child has the experience of being soothed. So if I'm the daughter and you're my father, you know, I'm in distress. So you pick up my distress. Now, you maintain a differentiated, you know, experience of selfhood so that, you know, if I've fallen down and, you know, my knee is now skinned and bleeding, you don't fall down and grab your own knee and scream out in pain. That would be where you'd become identical to me, but you sense my suffering and you reach out to connect with me. You know, in that connection, then my isolation and my own pain becomes expanded in a joining experience that for lots of reasons you could see would be a source of soothing. You know, so now I'm soothed. And then the third thing is safe. And safety has two aspects to it. One is that you are not going to be the source of terror for me, which creates what's called a biological paradox, because my brain stem deep in my, you know, palm of my hand and the model, you know, wants to go away from the source of terror. But the higher limbic area, which is a little newer, so the limbic region that's kind of the grounding of our attachment experiences, that's a mammalian part of the brain. It's 200 million years old. The brain stem, in contrast, is 300 million years old. So you have this older brain saying go away from the source of terror, but your limbic area and other higher regions of the cortex say, hey, I'm terrified. I should go toward my attachment figure to be soothed. But if the attachment figure is the source of terror, it's a biological paradox. There's nothing I can do. And so I fragment. That leads to what's called disorganized attachment. So parents should not be the source of terror. They should also be protecting their child from harm. Now, there's no such thing as perfect parenting. So anyone listening to this, just realize we all mess up. And the reason in every one of my parenting books, whether it's Brainstorm for, you know, adolescents and parents raising adolescents, or, you know, Parenting from the Inside Out, or, you know, which I did with Mary Hartzell, or all the ones I've done with Tina Payne Bryson, including The Power of Showing Up, you know, they're all about making sure the reader knows, even if you're a writer about these things, you mess up. So there's no such thing as perfect parenting. And the most important issue, besides being present as a parent, is to make a repair when there's a rupture.
Yep. Right? So can we spend a moment thinking about people who may have a ruptured relationship with their father?
Yeah. You mean like an adult or something? Or,
yes.
Or, yeah.
An adult who thinks about the relationship with their dad and doesn't feel so great about it.
I know.
Maybe doesn't feel like he was present in the ways that you're describing.
Yeah. Well, you know, in Parenting from the Inside Out, we give you like step-by-step ways of saying, what was my experience as a child that has now impacted me as a parent now? And it's based on this research that Mary Main created, the whole field of adult attachment interview research. And that's my area of research. And so with the adult attachment interview, we actually have scientific findings that say, based on your question, Ariel, you know, is that when you take the time to reflect on what happened to me in my childhood, and whether it's Parenting from the Inside Out or the very condensed summary in Brainstorm, there are lots of ways of seeing these questions. You go through these set of questions, and what it does, it guides you in a supportive way to say, what did happen to me? how can I make sense of those things that happened and what my strategies of dealing with them were? And then how have those direct experiences and adaptations and strategies of survival to those experiences, how have they stayed with me? How have they influenced my later childhood, my adolescence? How have they influenced my adulthood? And how are they influencing me if I am a parent as a parent? Now, what the research shows is that parents can have had the worst experiences in their life as children, but if they've taken the time to make sense of their life, they can earn or learn basically security. Now, likely that's because the brain is always open for continued growth throughout the lifespan. So when you make sense of your journey, you're actually integrating your brain. So I, as a therapist,
So that's what you do in trauma therapy.
That's what you do.
You take these stories that are unintegrated, that sit outside of yourself, that are so painful you can't even look at them, and you make them safe to re-expose yourself through them, safe to look at them again, and through that process reintegrate.
Right, exactly said beautifully. So, you know, a lot of people will say, gosh, what happened to me. Why would I go through the painful experience of living through it again? And you can understand that feeling, because if there was no reason to do it, don't do it. But the research is very clear. Parents who don't do it stay stuck in the trauma, that emotions may get out of control suddenly, and that you find you have intrusive memories of the past coming into you that influence your ability to be present. All those things basically are impediments to presence. They're blockages to integration. And so the course of making sense of your life, however you do it, is a journey toward integration. And even if we look at, you know, what I think ultimately the making sense process, feeling the senses, making an understanding part two, it integrates your brain left and right, up and down. So to get to your question about someone who can't forgive a parent, you know, Jack Kornfield has this very powerful statement when we teach together. He always says this, it's so powerful, that forgiveness is not saying that what happened to me was okay, or that the person doing this to me was a good thing, so I forgive them. No, that's not what forgiveness means. Instead, forgiveness can be better understood as giving up all hope for a better past. Right? Because we're always hoping, I wish it would have been better. I wish it would have been. I wish, oh my God, I hope it would have been better. Well, the past can't be changed. But how you make sense of the past and your relationship to the events of the past absolutely can be changed. So whether you're a person who can't forgive your father, what that means is you're actually on some level holding on to it if you're defining forgiveness as I'm hoping for a better past. Instead, when you realize many parents did the best they could, about a third to almost a half of parents really don't do that well. That's a huge percentage. You're talking about billions of people with insecure attachments. So they have various degrees of impaired integration in the brain. So presence is blocked. So unless they make sense of their lives because they can't be present as parents, they perpetuate the various subtle or not so subtle forms of insecure attachment onto the next generation, and on and on and on it goes. And so one of the reasons I take the time to write these books, or, you know, try to really understand it from a scientific point of view and then translate it for a practical use for the general public, is because not everyone can afford to go to therapy, but people can really afford to take a few moments of their day and try to be more mindfully present. They could take a few moments of their day and say, I deserve to make sense of my past so I can be more present for my kids, so I can break the cross-generational passage. So if someone is really saying, I don't forgive my father for this or that, I would ask them not to go and say, oh, Dad, I'm so glad you abused me and physically, sexually, emotionally, whatever you did, but rather to say, when you're without forgiveness, it's still eating at you. And at the same time, when you can forgive, giving up all hope for a different past, you actually liberate yourself from the prison of a painful past. And then you can move to integrate your life in a deep way. And as Father's Day is here, you know, sometimes fathers are the source of all sorts of negative things that happen or missing out on positive things. And you can actually have the strength to reach out to that person if you're estranged from whatever. And listen, if people are mean and nasty and giving you painful, harmful, toxic things, then not speaking to them is sometimes the best choice. And also, sometimes you might be surprised that when you develop this presence, you can reach out to people who you may never have thought you could connect with and connect with them.
That's amazing. Well, as a father, do you have any last words of wisdom? All of these words have been wise, but just as a father yourself.
Yeah, you know, as a father, I would say that two things. You know, we sometimes hear in our culture that fathers don't have an important role in child development. That message is absolutely wrong. The research shows we do have an important role. It may be different. We may, in looking at overall patterns, you know, learn to interact with kids in a different way, more rough and tumble or whatever. Learning to just be yourself and getting past blockages of really connecting to others, which sometimes our culture teaches us these ways you're not supposed to be emotional or not supposed to cry or you're not supposed to feel vulnerable. You know, these are all messages we get from culture that inhibit us from being fully present as a parent or a friend or a romantic partner. So it's all part of the same process of presence opens you up to really being available to connect with other people. That's the first thing. So anything you can do to develop a way of being aware to go beyond these would be really, really important. I guess what I would say as a second thing then is, if you take the two suggestions that Ariel and I have talked about today, which are number one, looking at what attachment is all about and making sense of your own life and asking yourself the question, what was my childhood like? How did it really enable me to be present for others or block me from that? There's a path forward. To actually doing these questions and help you explore what your past was like in a really supportive way. And while you can't change the past, you can change the way you understand how the past is still influencing you and open yourself up that way. The research is very clear that's true. You know, 30 years of clinical experience doing this shows that's true too. So that's number one. The second part of the second issue is there is a place for mindfulness. There is a place for training your mind to be focused in attention, open in awareness, and developing kind intention, these three pillars that produce all these positive changes, not only in your own physiology, but even in your brain. And those two things, developing the three pillar mind training practice in your life so you're more present, making sense of your life so you're more present for yourself and your children, they go hand in hand to make a more integrated life. And a more integrated life is a healthier life, a life with more kindness, compassion, and love. And that's something I think we can all support each other in that journey to a more integrated way of being.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Siegel, for your words of wisdom. Thank
My
you
pleasure.
For
Thank you.
Modeling awesome fatherhood.
Well, I hope so. Thanks. My kids are fantastic kids, and it's a privilege to be their dad. I'll say that.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. Thank you so much. Now we're going to actually share your Wheel of Awareness practice after this.
Fantastic. Yeah. And there's different ways to do it. There's a beginning one and a more advanced one, and find where you're at in your own practice and do it that way. Absolutely.
Excellent.
Yes.
Thank you so much for your time and your attention and your connection and love today.
You're welcome. Thank you, Ariel. Great to see you.
As always. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That was the amazing, wise, insightful Dr. Dan Siegel. You can find his many books on mindset, parenting, and more at drdansiegel.com. That's drdansiegel.com. There, you can also find a recording of Dr. Siegel's Wheel of Awareness that he was speaking about. And if you want to start or deepen your meditation practice, and know what's going on in your mind while you do so, Muse, the brain-sensing headband that helps you meditate, is an amazing tool to give you real-time feedback on your brain during your meditation practice. You can find out more at choosemuse.com, and you can use the discount code Untangle 15. For the full video of this conversation, you can find it at arielgarten.com. That's me, arielgarten.com. Patricia will be back next week with more Untangle. Until then, keep your neurons sparkling.